From WGCU, this is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Thousands of cancer patients lack a ride to the treatments they need to stay alive. Some don't have access to a vehicle. Others are simply too sick to drive themselves or use public transportation. Patients often face acute dietary restrictions or unique nutrition needs during and after their treatment. We'll talk with the people behind a volunteer program at the American Cancer Society working to help cancer patients get to their life-saving treatments. We'll also talk to a local chef with a special program to create health-conscious meals and deliver them to patients. And it's called Grab More, and it's the first novel by Southwest Florida author and historian Glenn Miller. He spent decades writing, reporting, and telling stories about Southwest Florida. Coming up, he'll talk about how those experiences shaped his new book and how he mixes the story with local history. But first, the news. Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Corporate greed, a missing CEO, and a cranky reporter come together in the debut novel by Fort Myers writer Glenn Miller. It's called Grab More, and many of the scenes play out right here in Southwest Florida. We're talking with Glenn Miller, of the author of the book. He is here in the studio with us. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Julie. And by the way, you have a great last name. I love your last name.
Yeah, and we spell it the same, two
N's.
Yes,
indeed. Yes.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call at 1-877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK, or find us on Facebook at WGCU Public Media. On Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So, Glenn Miller with the wonderful first name.
And Julie with the wonderful last name.
Without giving us a spoiler, tell us a little about the novel.
It's set in Southwest Florida.
Yes.
I like to call it a comic crime caper. The narrator is a sports writer at a fictional newspaper, which is part of a fictional large chain of newspapers, which has its headquarters somewhere up north. And it's I like to think it's a little bit of an absurdist look at the life inside of a large corporation, how people cope or how they don't cope. And a lot of it's set here. I like to create a sense of place here with the characters and with locations from downtown Fort Myers, Chocolosky, Rod and Gun Club in Everglades City, and the St. Pete Shuffleboard Club.
Oh, that's even
– yeah, yes, because I go all the way up to St. Pete. One of our my characters that I love, her name's Troxy, name I made up. She loves shuffleboard. She's obsessed with shuffleboard. And she walks around with a copy. This is true. There was a shuffleboard legend named May Hall. In 1964, Sports Illustrated wrote a story about her. So Troxy walks around with a photocopy of the 1964 story on May Hall. And she's basically got the story memorized.
She's just obsessed with shuffleboard.
And as well as Pinot Grigio.
Oh, wow. It's hard to be obsessed with Pinot Grigio.
It really is.
It kind of tastes like
kind of off-putting.
I mean, some Pinot Grigio is good.
Yeah, maybe Malbec, but not Pinot Grigio. So, yes, okay.
Well, you mentioned absurdist, and it kind of is because the name of the book is Grab More, and that's the name of the fictional media company that owns the local paper, Grab More.
Correct.
And the Tropical Times is the name of the paper.
Correct.
Which is set in Fort Myers, which is called Fort Myers. Right. So were you able to keep the name of the places real because those are real characters, but then you were able to get kind of crazy with the names of other things that you got to get pretty fictional on?
Yeah, I had tried to have fun with the names.
Yeah.
Like the narrator's name is F. Scott Bond. Okay. His backstory is his parents were English teachers. They loved F. Scott Fitzgerald, so they named him F. Scott. And his last name's Bond, like in James Bond.
Mm-hmm.
But he has none of the qualities of either. He's not a spy, a super tough guy, or brilliant. But he's sort of an everyman who copes with the absurd, the maddening life inside this large corporation.
Well, the names were incredible. The owner of the paper is Chester Ebenezer O'Reilly, whose initials spell CEO, and he goes by O'Reilly by all the people that work for him. I love that. How did you come up with these?
I don't know.
Mabel Borgia. Come on,
Borgia. Well, that was almost too easy.
That was awesome.
She's the ultimate office sycophant. Everybody in every field, it doesn't matter what industry you're in, I'm sure you run into people like her, people who will do
the kiss-ups.
Exactly.
Yes.
Yeah. Sycophant's a more pretentious word. But
well, you need to use your – I had to pull out the thesaurus every once in a while or the dictionary because, I mean, there were some multisyllabic words in there that kind of got – wait, I have to remember what that means because I don't use it every day.
Well, a doctor friend of mine, a retired physician, there's a – it's a very small part of the book. There's this chain of strip clubs called Strumpet. And he loves the word strumpet. He said hasn't seen the word in a long time.
So, mm-hmm.
Yeah, I tried to have fun with the names. And a lot of the names have a baseball connection. And all the historical elements are real things. Like May Hall was a real person. I mentioned Edgar Watson, who was killed in 1910 in Chokoloskee, famous story that's been immortalized in four books by Peter Matheson. That story is woven into the
That's the story of the guy that was an alleged murderer, and then everybody kind of ganged up on him. And
on October 25th, I want to say it was 1910, he came up in this little state-of-the-art powerboat, about one horsepower, to Chokoloskee, and the town folk there were tired of his bullying.
Was that at the store?
It was real close to where Smallwood store is. Which is mentioned in my book, but I don't know if it was 100 feet away from the store or 500 feet, but in the general vicinity of the Smallwood store. So the characters in the book, a person is held hostage down there in a safe house, and they tell him what happened to Edgar Watson in 1910 to further scare him to make sure he doesn't try to escape because bad things can happen there, you know, like incorporate the 10,000 Islands. Have you ever been in the 10,000 Islands?
I've been to the store, the Smallwood store.
But you haven't been back.
I haven't been all the way back.
It's hauntingly beautiful, but it's not a place you want to go if you don't know where you're going. So we tell the characters who have borrowed the CEO, tell them you don't want to go wandering back there because with 10,000 Islands, they all look alike. And if you don't know where you're going and there's critters out there you don't want to encounter. So they –
And there are no Frappuccinos there for him.
Exactly, yes.
Which he loved.
Yes. Well, it says girls from Iceland, Lapland, wherever that is.
It seems like you took delight in creating really despicable characters, right, including but not limited to the newsroom boss, whose hobbies include acting as a Confederate general in the Civil War reenactments, and he has people call him Colonel. His favorite movie is Birth of a Nation.
The original Birth of a Nation, not
yes,
the one that came out last year.
No, the Birth of a Nation, that haunted me since film history class back in college, and that's been a while.
Yeah, I remember seeing that in a film history class as well.
I think we were all required to have that one.
It might have been. But, yeah, it's
But for those that don't know, that was a pretty important film.
It was a groundbreaking film. It was a breakthrough. I'm not a film expert. A breakthrough in cinematography and storytelling and the length of it. But, unfortunately, the KKK is glorified as heroes in this movie.
Yeah.
And it's a favorite film, sadly, of the executive editor of this fictional newspaper.
When I read that, I was like, his favorite film is the original Birth of a Nation. That's the worst.
Right.
That is the worst possible. Did you have a favorite character in the book?
My favorite character is Troxy, the Pinot Grigio. I know you object to Pinot Grigio.
No, I don't have a problem. Sometimes it's good.
Okay. I love Troxy. She is a... I compare when she – I don't want to give away too much, but when she first enters the book, the narrator thinks she's sort of like Judy Holliday in the classic film Born Yesterday, which was released in 1950. It's kind of an airhead who talks unless you've seen the movie Born Yesterday.
I hate to admit it.
Yeah, you got to check out Born Yesterday. William Holden, Broderick Crawford, Judy Holliday won the Academy Award for her role as this – there's a difference between – not being smart, not being educated. Her character is not educated, but she's smart.
She's street smart, but comes across as an airhead.
Yeah, but William Holden in the movie is this guy. I'm going off on a tangent here, but he's hired to get her up to speed on book learning. But Troxy evolves in my book, the one who sounds initially like Judy Holliday, but she's a woman of many parts, as you'll see if you people who read it find out. But she has this harmless obsession with being a great shuffleboard player. And I've made a couple trips to the shuffleboard club in St. Pete, which is an amazing place. It's probably the greatest shuffleboard facility in the world. And this may be the first time in WGCU history you've discussed shuffleboard.
Probably
is.
I don't know. I haven't been here that long, but it's definitely the first time in my tenure.
Okay. But they have a grandstand there that seats about 300 people. It's
300 people watching shuffleboard.
I don't know if they ever filled the place up. But the grandstand's there, and it's a covered with a roof. It's an amazing place. I love Troxy. It's a made-up name. When people first meet her, they say Troxy. I mean, like Roxy Hart in Chicago.
Or Trixie.
And her great-grandfather is a real former Major League Baseball player who played for the Cleveland Indians. And then I get into the whole tangent.
Which weaves in your sports love and the love of baseball.
Right. And the Cleveland Crybabies. Not many people know about the Cleveland Crybabies.
Tell me about them. I don't know.
Not many people do. Amazing story. The Cleveland Crybabies had spring training here in Fort Myers.
The name of a team?
Well, let me get to that.
Oh, okay.
In 1940, the Cleveland Indians had spring training in Fort Myers. Very good team. They had a future Hall of Fame pitcher on the team named Bob Feller. As the season progressed, though, the players clashed with the manager, a guy named Ozzie Vitt, V-I-T-T, who was real old school. So if it's 1940 and he was old school in 1940, you know, he's really old. So the players complained to management that he was too mean. The word leaked out. And around Major League Baseball, the Indians became known as the Crybabies. And when they went on the road, fans threw baby bottles at them. Mm-hmm. And they were also called the Half Vitts. Ozzie Vitt, the manager, planned a screw pun. Instead of being half wits, they're half bits.
Oh, gotcha.
Yeah. So, but yeah, so it's all it's fun.
I'm acting like Troxy in the beginning of the novel. What? Sorry, I didn't understand. We're talking about the new novel, Grab More, with the author, Glenn Miller. You can become part of this conversation by giving us a call at 1-877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Or find us on Facebook at WGCU Public Media. Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So how has response been so far to your book?
Oh, my mom loves it.
Your mom? She's a big fan?
Yeah. No, sir, she has macular degeneration, so she can't read. She's always a big reader, so I read it to her. But so far, it's mostly friends and family.
Locals?
Yeah. Yeah, I had 2 5-star reviews on Amazon, but I'm hoping this will kickstart.
It's an entertaining read.
That's what I was setting out to do. I wanted to make this a fun, even frothy read. I didn't want it to be dark or bleak or even gritty, although I think it could have been a little grittier.
Well, I got to say, though, the main character spends a lot of time disliking almost everyone in positions of power in the paper. So chapters 1 through 4, he's shredding the CEO who's gone missing, thousands of possible suspects because he's so disliked. Then chapter 5, we meet the new sports editor named Bo Lowe, who – he shortened his name to Bo and spelled it B-O because he couldn't spell B-E-A-U. And he goes on to be a level of ignorant that I would have to hope is 100% fiction and not based on a real person anywhere. But your sports writer guy in the book, he's kind of a curmudgeon. I mean, how do you...
Well, yeah, how would you not be curmudgeon living in
when
that...
When that's your boss.
With that environment, too. Yeah. Yes, and the boss has an issue, sports editor boss. There's the prostate problem.
Yeah.
When a sports figure is diagnosed with prostate cancer, he tells his sports staff, we need to do a story finding out how many women have prostate cancer.
Yeah.
Yeah, so yeah, he's intellectually challenged, to say the least.
He was pretty bad. Yeah. But the sports writer, the main character, would you want to be this guy's friend?
Well, he's loosely based on me.
Oh, well, I guess you might want to hang out with him a little
yeah,
bit.
Yeah, well, I don't have a choice. But, yeah, I think so, because like me, he loves to read, loves old movies, loves baseball. And there's the baseball subtext all run through it. You know, tell stories that I think propel the narrative. We bring in how this company buys the local newspaper in the early 60s is because the son of the founder of the company comes to Fort Myers to see a spring training game with Bing Crosby, who I mentioned. And Bing Crosby was actually a part owner of the Pittsburgh Pirates who had spring training in Fort Myers, and Bing would come to spring training to check on his team.
It's kind of interesting because it's kind of a fuzzy line between the real history and the real actual stories. But then the thing that sets it apart is the characters that are not the history character or the place character, but the actual people are the ones that are the fictional characters that are based loosely, as you said, on yourself, for example, as the sports writer. Your career path wound through the local newspaper business here.
Correct.
Tell me a little about that. Are you from Fort Myers?
No, originally New Jersey, but I've been in Florida since before you were born. My family moved to St. Petersburg in 1961, so I've been in Florida 55 years, if my math is correct. I consider St. Pete home. I worked for an afternoon paper up there. That's how I got to know about the St. Pete Shuffleboard Club and the legendary shuffleboard player May Hall, who was indeed, like I said, profiled in Sports Illustrated in 1964.
So you just got to pull all these little things years of experience.
Yeah, the ether, so to speak. Yeah, and I really made it a point to anything historical, any historical reference was accurate. I mean, with my fictional characters, I was making things up. Like the founder of this company named O'Reilly, the great-grandfather of the current CEO, when he comes over as a 17-year-old in 1908 from Ireland, he comes over on a ship called, improbably, City of Cheaters.
Yeah, City
of
Cheaters.
Yeah, I mean, what the – but I did research on the names of ships that brought Irish immigrants over in the early 20th century. So I'm going through
– Was there actually
one? I couldn't believe it. I'm going through this list of names. I don't remember the names now.
I thought that was made up.
No, there actually was one. I thought this is too perfect. So I go through all these names. Don't ask me now. The Good Ship Lollipop, the SS.
I really want to look it up now. Now
yeah,
I want to know.
Yeah, but it's been a few years since I did that research. But yeah, so I go through the list, dozens, hundreds hundreds of names. Bingo.
How long did it take you to put all this whole story together?
Besides,
you know, reaching back in life to St. Petersburg and the shuffleboard. I mean, I don't know if we can include that in the novel writing process.
Well, the actual writing process took about a year.
Okay.
So, but I was also balancing that, you know, I got to make a living. I do a lot of freelance work for local publications like Florida Weekly. And
that's a hustle. That is tough to get together
and get
this freelance deal and that freelance thing and keep yourself
on
tech.
Well, you freelance too, you know the drill.
Yeah, and then you forget your deadline and you sit there at your computer and, oh, I got to get this out.
Right.
Yeah, it's hard to keep track of all that. So then being able to shoehorn putting together a novel is pretty admirable. It's hard. And it's a lot of writing. It's a lot of discipline.
Right. Well, thanks.
Yeah. It's discipline I do not have. The book pokes a lot of fun at corporate speak and really shines a light on how corporate consolidation can really go wrong, making middle-tier employees turn into fiercely competitive people and lower-tier employees feel like they're almost invisible and unappreciated. Do you think that's the case in every large corporation or just certain large corporations?
Well, I haven't worked in every large corporation,
obviously.
I would guess that's likely the case in all large corporations, even all large organizations. I have a character in my book named Milo Heller, who's the CFO of this company, chief financial officer. And that name is a subtle tribute to Joseph Heller, the author of Catch-22.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the characters in his book was a fellow named Milo Minderbinder.
So Minderbinder.
Yeah, what a name. I wish I'd come up with that name. But anyhow, so Catch-22 is one of my favorite novels of all time, brilliant book. It's a send-up of life inside the military, but it could be any large organization, an insurance company, a media company, a university, whatever. It's about the way people deal and don't deal with themselves and groupthink. And so that's why I named this character. I don't know if anybody's going to pick up on that, but Milo Heller.
It's timely, though, with the consolidation that's going on in media, especially regarding newspapers.
Especially right here in Southwest Florida.
Yeah, and newspapers, it seems like it's precarious, but then they keep on – I mean, financially, it's almost hard to avoid something like that, hard to avoid things getting together and being consolidated like that. But then the product at the end, I mean, there are a lot of really great writers that are still there, luckily for us.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think at the news press right off the top of my head, Melanie Payne, Amy Bennett Williams, they do great work. Janine Seitlin still there.
There are some really good people there.
Yeah, and excellent photographers that I've worked with over the years when I was there, and really good people. I made a point of mentioning in the book that the rank-and-file employees are almost without fail dedicated, ethical people.
Yeah.
It's dealing and coping with the corporate pettiness and insanity and absurdity. That
can be unfun even in smaller, medium size too. And I guess it kind of depends on who your boss is and then who the upper boss is. But when you see things, it's just kind of – it's a little tough sometimes. Tell me a little bit more about how your love and knowledge of local history came into play when you were doing this. I mean, I know you mentioned the Smallwood store incident and a couple of other things, but – and the shuffleboard people.
Well, yeah.
So tell me a little bit more about your history.
Yeah, I'm a huge history buff. I'm the vice president of Southwest Florida Historical Society. So I'm involved in history all the time. I'll be speaking Thursday, not about the book, at the LaBelle Heritage Museum about the Historical Society. Now, I love local history. I've written over the years probably hundreds of local history stories for Florida Weekly, the news press, local magazines.
Which is interesting because there aren't that many people that have been around here that long that know much about the history.
Right, yeah. So it reminds me of something that happened a couple weeks ago at the Historical Society where I volunteer. We had a young woman come in. She's a college student. She goes to UCF in Orlando. She loves history. She came in. She wants to volunteer with us. We thought, hey, that's great. And to her friends, they don't understand history. To them, it's just dates. Something happened in 1911 or 1066. But she understands history is stories. History is people. So it's the stories that resonate.
And they also have an influence on
– and they can have a long-lasting influence, yes.
And they can answer questions of why things are the way they are in certain places and why people are the way they are. It is pretty important.
Yeah, I wove into the story the 1939 Thelma Rice case, which I would imagine less than 1% of your audience has ever heard of Thelma Rice.
I have not. Tell me.
Okay. 1939. I love these old-time names. This is a true story. Thelma Rice and her sister Gertrude – came to Fort Myers. They rent an apartment on Superior Street just east of what is downtown. Thelma was 25 in 1939. So one night in August, she meets a fellow named Earl Randolph Haskew at a juke joint in North Fort Myers. Mm-hmm. And they start drinking. And then they move on to a place in downtown Fort Myers called, I think it had two names, Lanier's and the Parkview Pharmacy. And they had some more. They had what were called setups. I never heard of this research story. A setup is, I'm not a drinker, I think a Coca-Cola and whiskey or something like that. But she was quite drunk. And when I did the story originally several years ago, I met the last person to see them together and the last person to see Mr. Haskew alive. That was a guy named Louis Furin. In 1939, he was a 17-year-old Fort Myers High student. And he was working part-time at the pharmacy that night. They came in and they were drinking and they drove out to Fort Myers Beach and one thing led to another, including some skinny dipping. And he asked for, this was what how it was termed in the newspaper, an unusual intimacy. Listeners can take use their imagination. But she, poor Thelma, was scared. She had just met this guy and things were getting out of hand. And she reached into his car. We had a 32 and she was scared. You know, it's a 25-year-old woman, didn't know anybody in town. So she shot him once. Boom, he didn't go down. She shot him a second time. Boom, he didn't go down. Shot him a third time. Boom, he didn't go down. And he went the third time he went down.
So he was like Rasputin.
Sort of, yeah. So she then jumped into his car. I think it was my 1938 Plymouth. And she started driving north. You know, this is long before an interstate highway system. So she went up 41, picked up a hitchhiker near Gibsonton. And the hitchhiker was quoted in the papers at the time saying this woman who picked him up was talking about she killed a guy in Fort Myers. And the guy was kind of scared. So she dropped him off.
Well, yeah, one might be, yes.
Yeah, one might be. And then so she kept driving north after she dropped this guy off in Tampa. She stopped in Cross City, which is up near Tallahassee somewhere. She got a job as a waitress at Joe's Cabins or something like that. But the cops were looking for her all over the South. And she ended up turning herself into a guy. Real old-time name. This is a real name. There was a guy named Gid Powledge. He was the chief of police in Tallahassee. So she went to Tallahassee, turned herself into Gid. They brought her back to Fort Myers and had a trial. She was convicted of manslaughter, sentenced to 10 years, served, I think, four. And after that, I don't know what happened to her. But Thelma Rice. But in my story, my character Troxy has told this story. And she, the 1939 Thelma Rice character, gave a jailhouse interview where she says her example should serve as an example to other women not to go drinking with strange men. And Troxy's alone with these guys. They might be eccentric, but they're not dangerous. Mm-hmm. So she makes a joking reference that she's like Thelma. She finds herself drinking with strange men.
I wonder if her name was the inspiration behind using like Thelma and Louise.
I don't think the story was that
well known. It's not the same story. But
yeah, it's two women. Yeah, so I have no idea what happened to Gertrude, what happened to Thelma. But I did a story for the news press several years ago when I stumbled across this story in the archives.
Isn't it fun stumbling across stories like that?
Yeah, it is fun. I had never heard of this story. I was looking through old newspapers on microfilm, researching something else about the history of radio stations here, and I came across this front page story, this woman wearing a print dress, everything, no color pictures then, but and big headlines about her trial.
Wow. Remember,
yeah, it's an incredible story. So that's woven into the story. And, yeah, I love the local history from the crybabies to May Hall to
– the Cleveland crybabies. I kind of feel
I couldn't resist not using that.
Well, you have to – when somebody's tough on you, you got to whine about it a little bit. But
I guess so.
I don't know. That doesn't look good when you're in sports.
No. You don't want to be called a crybaby. You don't want people throwing baby bottles at you if you're a professional athlete.
I didn't even know that happened.
Well, very few people do. You have to be – the term is seamhead. Are you familiar with the term seamhead?
No.
Seamhead is a hardcore
– like the seam of the baseball?
Yes. This is somebody who's an avid baseball fan.
Oh, wow.
Or a baseball nerd maybe might be more appropriate.
I am not one of those. Okay. All I know about is the Kansas City Royals in 1985, and that's it.
Who had spring training at Fort Myers.
That's my entire life story of baseball knowledge. We are talking about the new novel Grabmore with the author Glenn Miller. You can become part of our conversation by giving us a call at 1-877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK, or you can find us on Facebook at WGCU Public Media. On Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCO. Now, you've been a writer, and you've been writing for a long, long time, and you've been writing in smaller, you know, constraints. How hard was it to get a whole novel out?
Actually, it was kind of liberating.
Really? You didn't have to edit down?
No. You know, all the years I've been working as a sports writer or a general assignment writer for magazines and newspapers, you know, I adhere to an old school edict about how you approach your work in journalism, the three most important rules. You know what they are?
Tell me.
The three most important rules in journalism are 1, accuracy, 2, accuracy, 3, accuracy.
Yeah, I was always like second source everything, and third.
Well, this old story, if your mom tells you she loves you, get a second source. But yeah, sadly, you know, journalism is a human endeavor and people make mistakes, but I always strove to get things right. In the novel, even though I was really tried hard to make all the historical references accurate, I could – just make things up.
You can just make it fun.
Yeah, make it fun. Change a quote. I never changed a quote in journalism, but I'll be working on quotes. I don't know. That doesn't sound right. Or I change the person who said it. I say character A said something. I think, no, it would be better if character B says this. So it was great fun. Like I'm working on a sequel to this now, and I had a first name for a new character, and I thought about, I don't like that name. Now, you couldn't do that writing a story about the Tampa Bay Bucks and change because you don't like the first name of a player and change it. But you're writing a novel, you're not too crazy about the name of a new character. Yeah, the heck, let's go with this other name instead.
It's kind of nice.
Maybe it's fun. Yeah.
You said it's kind of loosely based on you and your life,
right?
Story and history and experience. Not that there was ever a disappeared CEO.
Not that I won't comment about any involvement in any major federal felonies.
But not on the radio, maybe.
Yeah. But my character, he plays in a local rec baseball league. Mm-hmm. And when I was younger, I played in a local rec baseball league. And I mentioned the league by name. It's Roy Hobbs Baseball. You remember the movie The Natural?
I didn't watch it. I'm sorry. I'm just not a baseball person.
Okay.
So
anyhow.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah. And, the movie is based on a real incident. In the movie
– oh, is that If You Build It, They Will Come? Is that that?
No, that's Field of Dreams.
Okay,
but
sorry.
Robert Redford plays Roy Hobbs, and he's this amazingly gifted as a young man, very gifted ball player, going to be one of the all-time greats.
Okay, yes, I remember that.
Okay,
one.
So
yes,
anyhow, so he gets shot. Barbara Hershey, I think, plays the woman, mm-hmm, whose goal is to shoot famous athletes who are going to be great. So she shoots him, and that's based on a real incident that Bernard Malamud, the author of the book, used in 1947 or maybe 48, there was a guy named Eddie Waitkiss with the Phillies, and there was a young woman named Ruth Ann Steinhagen, mm-hmm, who was obsessed with poor Eddie. Eddie didn't know it. This Ruth Ann Steinhagen, real person, she built a shrine to him in her home, their bedroom. So the Phillies go to Chicago, check in the hotel, and this woman contacts Eddie and says, I have something for you. Poor Eddie goes to see her. She said, I got a surprise for you. She pulled out a .22 and shot him.
Yeah.
Fortunately, he survived. Yeah. He actually came back to play about a year later. And she didn't go to prison. She was had some mental health issues.
She was institutionalized.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yes.
But that's woven into the fabric of the story. I hope it's woven in seamlessly, but not like a seam head. So.
But it's amazing that you are able to remember these people's names. I know you love history and you're a historian, but I can hardly remember names for 10 seconds. But you're remembering names and pulling names out of – that's a pretty remarkable ability that you have.
Well, thanks.
So you made it into a novel rather than a memoir.
Right. I wanted to – well, I always – wanted to write a novel. You know, I took creative writing classes in college, mm-hmm, and always been a big reader. I think if you want to be any sort of writer, you got to be a reader. So, I always had a itch to write a novel. And after taking a buyout and having more free time, I decided it was time to sit down and write the novel. And I had the idea, the premise for it. And it was just a matter of sitting down and creating the characters. And I wanted to make it a fun read.
How long had you thought about it before you actually sat down?
Before I was thinking about the story and the characters for 2 or 3 years of when I leave the paper, I'm going to sit down and write a novel. And as I – throughout the process, I changed some things. I thought about how a certain character would be. I thought, I think it would be better to make this character more like this than that. So the characters evolved in my mind, changed in my mind. Like the grandfather of the shallow, venal, lecherous CEO of the company, I was going to make him the great-grandfather, the founder as shallow, lecherous, mean as his great-grandson. But I thought it would be a better story if he was a vastly different guy, a man of substance, a man who, quote, Yeats and Shelley and read the great novels in history, make him a tough guy but a fair guy as opposed to his great-grandson who's this shallow guy, goes flying off to Iceland to meet contestants in the Miss Iceland pageant.
Yeah, the legend is that usually the first generation makes all the money and it takes two generations for it all to get squandered away.
Right, yeah, sort of the case here. The great-grandfather comes to the country 1908 with nothing. With nothing, yeah. He doesn't even have soap. So he goes to the Brooklyn Daily Eagle, which was a real newspaper, and asks for a job, and he meets the editor there. He's been in the steerage of this ship, the City of Cheaters, for a week or 10 days, and he hasn't had a bath in a while. So
it's
the editor says –
pretty ripe.
Yeah.
I'm sure.
So the editor gives him $5, said, go take a bath, get some soap, come back tomorrow. Be here at 8. We'll talk about it.
And he said, I'll be there at 7.
Right.
He goes, okay, great. When I get here at 8, we'll come over.
So it's all about – I wanted to make my characters likable for the most part, except for the obvious villains.
Yeah.
I wanted to make my narrator somewhat likable. I wanted to make Troxy somewhat likable, like to make the Confederates of my narrator likable people that people would want to spend time with.
Yeah, I think it's really an interesting read. It's really fun. Is there anything about this particular time, though, in the last year that made you really want to sit down and focus and get it done?
Well, actually, it was written 3 years ago. I submitted the manuscript to Martin Sisters Publishing in 2013.
Oh, okay.
So it was accepted in 2013. But I don't know what was going on inside the company. They're based in Kentucky. I think they were basically dormant for a while. So it was a three-year wait between the time the novel, the manuscript was accepted until it was published in November.
So when did you get the news that it was accepted?
Oh, this is great. It just never happens. So I submitted the manuscript, or at least part of it.
And then you didn't hear anything?
No, actually I did. Like on a Tuesday in August of 2013. I remember it was precisely 1 week later I was offered a contract, which usually never happens. I was like, wow, this is cool.
Mm-hmm.
I was very excited. I was thinking, wow, by 2013 Christmas, maybe it'll be out. It was out in time for Christmas 2016. But it's finally out, and my mom, who's going to be 86 in a couple of weeks, is really happy, and that means a lot.
That is pretty exciting. Yeah. This is great to be able to make mom proud.
Indeed.
Well, and the whole area, because you're really kind of casting Fort Myers in the whole Southwest Florida in a pretty interesting light.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I mentioned things about going into the Starbucks in downtown Fort Myers.
Mm-hmm.
Saying it was in the old Crest Building, which was built, I don't remember now, 1928, and about how the Crest Building, downtown Fort Myers, is one of the oldest buildings down there. So,
yeah,
I wanted to incorporate the real and the fanciful and mix them all together.
Yeah, downtown is definitely looking gorgeous, too, and I love the old buildings. Do you like the brick roads and everything?
Oh, I love the
brick
roads.
Great.
Yeah, I remember when they were doing the streetscape project.
Yeah.
It's the downtown looks awesome. I love the way it looks.
It's fun down here seeing history being preserved because people generally don't think of this area as having historic significance. But as you point out in so many ways and even through your work of fiction, that it is a big part of this area.
Oh, indeed.
And still very much alive.
Right, yeah. Yeah, William Faulkner had a famous line. I won't get it exactly right. Something about the past is never dead. It's always with us, or words to that effect. Yeah. So what happened in Fort Myers in 1900, 1910 still lives on in the buildings downtown and maybe cultural ways, social ways.
I believe so. Well, we have to leave it there for today. Thank you for coming in today, Glenn Miller. Book Grab More is available on Amazon. Congratulations once again. Our show today was produced by Matthew Smith and directed by Richard Chinqui with technical help from A.J. Leonard. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. Tomorrow on Gulf Coast Live, a massive federal water bill passed last month is big news for the Everglades. But what does the $2 billion project mean for South Florida? We'll break it down with planners of the Everglades Coalition Conference. Plus, StoryCorps has arrived in Southwest Florida to record, preserve, and share stories from our region. We'll talk with the people organizing the show in Fort Myers and share stories from past stops in the Sunshine State. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Julie Glenn. This is WGCU-FM, Fort Myers, 90.1, WMKO Marco Island, 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.